This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. About 14% of the waste that goes to the McLean County landfill is organic, and that's worth trying to reduce.
Food waste, so trying to look at some of the bigger institutions, some of the bigger grocery store chains, things like that here in the community.
Planning the next 20 years of solid waste disposal and recycling, and getting ready for a landfill closure with the Ecology Action Center Director Michael Brown. Plus, a streetcar man reflects on his life in Bloomington, mourning Abraham Lincoln, not a sad thing for some people after the assassination, and how do you tell a rogue tweet from a fake one? All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT. With additional support from the Jack Batal Real Estate Group, more information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This weekend is Abraham Lincoln's birthday. Today we examine his death and reaction to it. We've all heard how the nation was sent into a period of shock and grief when word of Lincoln's murder spread. Newspapers reported it that way. But what about the average American, North and South, black and white? Martha Hodes set out to learn more from their letters and personal notes. IPR Sean Crawford talked with the New York University professor who wrote a book on the subject, Mourning Lincoln. Hodes says she wanted to bring intimate thoughts to light from the months after Lincoln's death.
Well, lots of people have written about Lincoln's assassination, but most scholars and writers who've written about Lincoln have written about public responses. So they've used newspaper articles or sermons or public expressions of condolence, and all of those are important points. But nobody had thought to read through the hundreds and hundreds of letters and diaries and other personal writings that were created in the immediate aftermath of the assassination, so literally in the hours, days, and weeks following Lincoln's assassination. So by reading through these sources, and I did read through hundreds and hundreds of such sources, of course there are many I didn't get to, but by reading through those sources, we get a different vision. We get a vision of a nation that is not united in mourning, which is something that many of the public sources claim. We get a vision of a nation quite divided right at the end of a civil war that terribly divided the nation. So that's what was so interesting to me. The personal responses illuminate a key moment of confusion and conflict that's been left out of the story.
Certainly, people in the South may have taken quite often a different view of Lincoln when he was alive and even in death. Is it your take that maybe people might have felt differently about his assassination had it not been for the Civil War, and especially had it not been so close to the end, the defeat of the Confederacy?
For Confederates, the trauma of the moment was less Lincoln's assassination than the fact that they had just lost this terrible four-year bloody war. And you can see that in personal writings of Confederates, because at times they will make a notation of the assassination but spend most of their time lamenting the defeat. Now, when Confederates thought about Lincoln and Lincoln's assassination, two things happened. First, Confederates did despise Lincoln, and that was because of the Civil War, and of course his election is what prompted secession. But the other point that's so interesting is at the same time the Confederates are celebrating Lincoln's assassination, because it's almost like a moment of reprieve for them from the horror of defeat, they're also worried because they have this sense that Lincoln would have been good to them had he lived, whether or not that's true. So while the freed people are calling Lincoln their best friend after his assassination, so are white Southerners calling Lincoln their best friend right after assassination. By the way, that wasn't something that developed later over the years and decades of the Lost Cause. It was something I found on the day Lincoln died in white Southern writings.
And there has always been that theory that Reconstruction might have gone differently had Lincoln lived. People were worried, you know, what happens to me? What happens to the South? What happens to the way of life that I've known? And especially with somebody unknown taking the White House.
People think at first, or I should really say white Northerners and white Southerners think at first that Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's successor, the vice president, is going to be tougher on former slaveholders and the Confederates because Johnson is known to have hated the Southern aristocracy. African Americans, however, have a sense right from the start that this is not going to be the case. And African Americans know this, and I realize this through reading letters in black newspapers and Frederick Douglass and other kinds of black voices. Johnson's roots are as a poor white Southerner. And they make the point, African American mourners make the point, that Johnson hates black people more than he hates the Southern aristocracy. And that's, of course, what turns out to be true in Reconstruction. Johnson essentially sides with the Confederates and dismisses African Americans. And I have many petitions and letters that African American mourners wrote to Johnson saying things like, think about what your noble predecessor would have done, you know, were he alive. And Johnson does not follow through on the policies of black, not just black freedom. I mean, freedom has been gained, but equality, citizenship, land, education. So we do not know, we cannot know what would have happened had Lincoln lived. But there is a sense, and Frederick Douglass makes this point, that he would have listened to black petitioners. He would have listened to African Americans, the freed people, black politicians, black leaders, in a way that Johnson did not. Johnson dismissed those people out of hand when the war was over and he took the presidency.
For African Americans, they had had one of their, you know, one of the greatest victories that they had known up to that point during Lincoln's presidency, emancipation. Without Lincoln there, many of them felt as though that the rug would be pulled back out from under them, correct?
Absolutely. Of course, African Americans had been critical of Lincoln during the war. They thought that he was too slow to act upon emancipation. By the time the war was over, Lincoln had been influenced greatly by African Americans and by white abolitionists as well. And, of course, there was the Emancipation Proclamation by then. There was the second inaugural address by then in which Lincoln made clear that slavery was the cause of the war and God would not let the war end until slavery was over. And then there was the last speech that Lincoln made. Of course, no one knew it would be his last speech when he stood on the White House balcony on April 11th, in which he hinted at his preference for suffrage for certain groups of black men. So once Lincoln was assassinated, African Americans, you're absolutely right, were devastated and proceeded to invoke Lincoln as a model of a radicalism that he may or may not have lived up to had he lived. But the fear among African Americans was very great, and white mourners conceded that the loss was greater for African Americans than for themselves. In their diaries and letters, they would make that point.
We're talking with Professor Martha Hodes. She's the author of Mourning Lincoln. You feel as though that the public may be a little misinformed when it comes to Reconstruction and how that was handled because of Lincoln's death?
Yes. So there is a misconception that because Lincoln was assassinated, the North was harsher on the vanquished Confederacy. What I found in reading through all of these sources was that people understood, Lincoln's mourners understood the assassination as a message from God indicating that God had to take Lincoln away because otherwise the Confederates would not be treated with the kind of harshness they needed to be treated with in order to make the nation move forward. So instead of avenging Lincoln's assassination, the Union wanted to avenge war, secession and war, and also slavery, because people were very clear, mourners were very clear, not only abolitionists, that Lincoln was assassinated because of slavery. That was what was to blame. Of course, Booth was to blame and Confederate leaders were to blame, but slavery was the cause of the assassination. And people made that comment even before they went to church on Easter Sunday, and ministers made that comment. So the treatment of the Confederates during Reconstruction was a result of everything that had led up to Reconstruction without the assassination making it any worse. That's not what people were avenging. And I think it's very important to understand that people took this, Lincoln's mourners took this as a message from God to move the nation, especially in the view of black and white radicals, giving African Americans the vote, education, land, citizenship, equality, freedom.
And we talked about the South, but what about the North? And what we've always heard, as you'd mentioned earlier, was that newspaper accounts were that the North was in a terrible mourning after the assassination. Is that what you found in these personal writings?
Well, yes, in many ways. I expected to find that the major responses would be shock and grief, and they were. So people were utterly astounded, stupefied. They couldn't believe it was real. They were overcome with gloom and grief. Men were weeping in the streets. All of that was true. What I also found in the North was that Lincoln's opponents, the so-called Copperheads, were celebrating the assassination in some of the same ways that Confederates were celebrating the assassination. So they were reveling, they were laughing and clapping and cheering in the streets. Of course, some people stayed out of sight for fear, and the ones who did demonstrate that kind of glee were threatened and sometimes visited with violence. They made jokes about Lincoln. Just to give one example, one man made the comment that he has as much of a brain now as he ever had, which was a reference to John Wilkes Booth shooting him in the head. Union soldiers and sailors who were Copperheads said terrible things about Lincoln and were visited by the wrath of their comrades. So not even the North was wholly unified. And what's so interesting is that Lincoln's mourners will say in one sentence, "The whole world is mourning." And then in the next sentence in a diary or letter, we'll describe some of the people in their town who are not mourning Lincoln, but who are reacting with glee. So they know it's not true, but it's a kind of comforting trope that the whole world is mourning for Lincoln.
Many of us, if we didn't live through it, certainly have seen many times the assassination of John F. Kennedy on television and the film that that has become so famous of that. We didn't have that film of Lincoln. Do you think those two incidents were treated differently because of the lack of the visual imagery, or could you tell that from what you were reading?
When Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, people got the news from television or radio, and then television was the key way of making this real, that this had really happened. If you didn't have a television at home in 1963, you stood out on the sidewalk in front of an appliance store watching television in the window, in a crowd of people. Today, if there was a catastrophe, people would turn to their cell phones and social media. When Lincoln was assassinated, people would get the news from a telegram or the newspaper, sometimes the morning it happened if the telegraph lines were connected. And then it seemed so unbelievable that the first thing people did in 1865 was leave the house and verify that this had happened by looking into one another's faces. So over and over again in diaries and letters, I would find descriptions of people saying, "I immediately got up from the breakfast table. I got dressed. I went outside. I looked into the stricken faces around me. I saw expressions of horror and grief. I saw tears rolling down people's cheeks." People knocked on doors. They rapped on windows. They told other people. The way to see that this had really happened was to verify human expressions. So sometimes I like to say not Facebook, but human faces in 1865. That was essential to understanding that this event had really come to pass.
Martha Hodes is the author of Mourning Lincoln. It looks at reaction to Lincoln's death. The 209th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's birth is this Sunday. American Legion members are making their annual pilgrimage to Lincoln's tomb. It will be the 83rd consecutive year the pilgrimage has been held, making it the longest continuously running Lincoln birthday event in the U.S. Last year, more than 200 American Legion members from across the nation attended in Springfield. Sunday's event will include speeches and a placement of a wreath at the former president's tomb at Oak Ridge Cemetery. State and local dignitaries will be attending, as well as American Legion members. While the American Legion is encouraging public attendance.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Symphony Orchestra, performing Beethoven's Prometheus Overture and Lyrical Violin Concerto featuring Dutch violinist Simone Lamsma, guest conducted by Ken Lamb, Saturday, February 25th at the BCPA. Details at ilsymphony.org. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Today's Connect Transit bus system has its roots in Bloomington Normal more than 130 years ago. A new form of transportation connected Bloomington residents in the late 1800s, a horse railway. In today's episode of the GLT series McHistory, we hear about a veteran driver and conductor on this early form of transit.
You know, I know all about work, for I have been standing on the platform of these streetcars for 17 years. I'm Jeff Woodard with the McLean County Museum of History.
David Law is a quite interesting figure. He worked for the Street Railway Company for 33 years, and a lot of folks that are living in Bloomington Normal probably don't realize that Bloomington Normal had a street railway system, which was not uncommon in the 19th and early 20th century. I'm Bill Kemp, librarian, McLean County Museum of History. So it's developed first in 1867, 2 years after the Civil War, as horse-drawn streetcars.
When I commenced work for the company, I was just 17 years old. Now I'm 34 and have a wife and a baby. I've never done anything else but drive streetcars, and I began to think now that I will never until I get to the other world, where wings are said to be used as motive power in preference to mules.
When David Law first starts working for the company in 1872, he's a streetcar driver, driving a mule or horse team and pulling a streetcar. By 1890, the system will be electrified, so he will become then a motorman, running a electrified streetcar.
Joe Pfeiffer used to be a passenger on my car when he attended the Wesleyan, and now I carry his son, Herman, to and from the Normal.
The streetcar system was, in Bloomington Normal, one of the common levelers of community life, in that, like the bus system today, you would have all walks of life. Although back in the streetcar days, you had upper middle class and comfortably middle class people riding the streetcars as well.
Yes, you are right. It is a rather hard life. On the line, we have to start out from the stables at 7:10 in the morning and work until 10:30 at night.
So it was a really nice area for the community as a whole to interact, from working class Irish folk to very wealthy East Siders taking the streetcar in to work at the bank downtown. So David Law worked for 33 years for the company.
I live close to the stables, and so I can go home for my short meals. But most of the drivers just eat cold lunches for dinner and supper.
They only would get two breaks during the day, 20 minutes, for lunch and dinner. So most of them ate cold lunches in the horse barn. So the working conditions were not the best, obviously. The conditions themselves were okay, but the hours were quite awful.
On all the other lines, the drivers have to commence work at 6:45. This means getting up not far from 5 o'clock 7 days in the week. And I tell you, 5 o'clock comes mighty early these days. It seems like rather small wages for so many hours. The new men get $40 a month, and those longest in the company's employ get $50. We haven't any pickings or prerequisites either, and we have to work Sundays as well as Mondays.
They did make decent wages for the day in 1889, akin to, if you would adjust for inflation today, it'd been equal to us, between $1,000 and $1,300 a week, which wasn't that bad. But yet, given the hours they were working, 7 in the morning to past 10 at night, it was a very difficult life.
But 2 months ago, a lot of drivers made an arrangement whereby every 10 drivers would pay the wages of an extra driver, so that now every one of us takes a day off every 10 days. Of course, we lose that day, but by this means, we have 1 day in 10 to get acquainted with our wives and families.
The system is electrified in 1890, and then in 1893, David Law is involved in a horrific accident. He's a motorman, so he's running a electrified streetcar, but he's also the ticket taker or the conductor. So he's in the back of a vehicle taking tickets, talking to some paying customers when there's a horse coming at him. A young man is overturned by the horse, and the streetcar runs over this young man, and this young man is killed. David Law is not to blame for that, but the company is, because they should have had both a motorman and a conductor on the streetcar. And in fact, that's what will happen after this accident. So although this accident involves the death of a young man, it does end in a significant policy change to ensure that someone was always paying attention to where the streetcar was headed.
Why, bless your heart, the average well-dressed and comfortable citizen who rides the streetcars don't know anything about us or men like us. We hardly see our children, for they are asleep when we leave in the morning and have gone to bed when we get back at night. The children of many of the drivers never see their fathers except once in 10 days, and then they ask their mother who that strange man is around the house.
David Law, interesting, would never serve as a motorman again, though he would remain with the company for a little while.
By the time we pay our house rent, our grocers and butcher's bills, pay for our clothes, fuels, and lights, we have mighty little left, even when we are in good health. And when sickness comes, it is apt to go a little hard with some of us. The company treats us very well, though, and never discharges a man except for calls.
There was no pension system, which was standard for the day in the industrial age. There was no medical insurance. So these drivers really lived a very precarious life. They did organize a union in 1902 and then struck in 1904. This was a time when striking workers had very little support, so the company, the streetcar system, brought in strike breakers. Some unrest ensues, as was common back then. The striking workers then upturn and partially demolish six streetcars. The strike lasts more than 6 months, and finally the strikers and David Law are broken.
How many miles have I traveled during the time I've been a streetcar driver, do you ask? Well, I don't have very much time to figure. But some of the smart Normal and Wesley students whom I carry every day have figured it out. The route has now been shortened so that now the round trip is only 5 miles, but it used to be six. I make 15 round trips a day. In the 17 years that I have been a streetcar driver, I have traveled 558,450 miles. That would be more than 23 times around the globe. It would have been enough to carry me to the moon, back to the Earth again, a second time to the moon, and a small part of the way back to the Earth again.
And then Law leaves the streetcar company and begins to work for the Illinois Central Railroad, which also runs through Bloomington. And he will pass away in 1916. The year after David Law passes away, the streetcar employees finally will successfully unionize. The Bloomington-Omaha streetcar system will remain active and in use as late as the Great Depression. It will finally become defunct in 1936. It will be killed, as most streetcar systems were, by the automobile and the internal combustion engine buses.
I have stood on this platform with thermometer 24 to 30 degrees below zero, and I have made my way through mountainous snow drifts and when the rails were a glare of ice, as well as through beating rains and burning suns. No, we haven't a soft job, and we literally earn our bread by the sweat of our brow.
During the renewed labor protest in which streetcar workers won union representation, famed activist Mother Jones came to Bloomington in solidarity with the streetcar workers. The series McHistory is done in partnership with the McLean County Museum of History, bringing you the words and times of central Illinois residents of other eras. You heard the voices of Bill Kemp and Jeff Woodard.
What is it like to work in the warehouse of the retailer that we all order from?
Go to this section, this region, find a Malibu Barbie.
You got 15 seconds to find the region that has the shelf, that has the bin, that has the Barbie.
This is like a bin full of crap.
Products seem haphazardly stored next to each other.
Why does this product exist? I asked my supervisor, can I pee? And he was like, of course, this isn't China, but it's going to hurt your numbers.
That's on the next Radio Lab. Listen Sunday at 11 on GLT News and Ideas.
Support for GLT Sound Ideas comes from the Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams, committed to helping you find the right match. Buying or selling your home can be easy. More information at jacksguarantee.com. This is GLT.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A social media phenomenon has erupted since the inauguration of President Trump: rogue Twitter accounts. These accounts purport to be authored by current or former government employees who no longer feel comfortable using government accounts to tweet information. The Twitter accounts mirror NASA, national parks, the EPA, even presidential staff. The tweets cover alleged plans to sell federal lands, West Wing White House insider info, and climate change. GLT's Mike McCurdy talks with Nate Carpenter, who runs the Social Media Analytics Command Center at Illinois State University. Carpenter says the Smack Lab is tracking 44 rogue accounts in an effort to sort out what is real and what is not.
Tend to be those that are the most legitimate, those that are coming out really right during the inauguration, or those that are coming out directly after Donald Trump had lambasted the National Park Service for retweeting some images of Obama's and Trump's inaugurations for comparative purposes. We also see a bunch of them erupt very quickly after the statements made by Kellyanne Conway about alternative facts. And in fact, that's where many of them got their initial names. That use of alt in their names refers to the alternative,
sure.
In that same sense. And so the earlier they are to that moment, the more likely they are to be those, legitimate accounts in terms of being made by the federal employees in response to these moments.
But maybe we shouldn't rule out later accounts, because it could be that some people are just getting fed up. It just takes them longer to hit that breaking point, and they may be starting accounts later. Is there any way, do you think, to sort of apply a metric to this, or to look at it with a certain set of eyes to say, yeah, that one's maybe real, this one's maybe fake?
Well, a couple of ways that we look at that include what kinds of content are they posting? So if we look at the original spirit of many of these alt accounts, it was to produce scientific information, that which was under a gag order, especially scientific research that was being prevented from being shared to the public. And so when we look at the accounts that tended to produce that kind of content, and again, these tended to be fairly nonpartisan, posts about climate change, and slowly they've evolved more.
Wait,
now.
You just said climate change. Just nonpartisan? I'll note that here. Okay.
Sure. Yep. Yep. Well, at least in terms of how they've been approaching
sure,
science.
Sure.
Yep. Exactly.
I was making a bad joke. This all started when the Badlands National Park in South Dakota sent out some climate change tweets in defiance of the Trump administration, and then those tweets were later deleted. A little while later, we saw Bad Hombre Lands NPS sort of take over. Since many of us keep informed, send, get news on Twitter, how should we weigh this account and some of the other accounts as news sources?
Certainly. So first, we have to really pay attention again to the message. What is it designed to do? In many cases, accounts like this are designed to inform. And again, that is the initial idea behind many of these, to continue that flow, that stream of science. The next layer that we'll see happen is that they want to invoke outrage. And so they will post things that are would otherwise be really disturbing to those who know these areas. And as soon as those kinds of posts start to happen, that's the sense that I start to say there may be some distortion put into place, that there may be, again, a particular, I don't want to say spin on it, but there may be facts that are omitted, or, again, a call to action about something that may not be as significant as otherwise indicated.
On the flip side, if so-called official accounts are being gagged, how reliable are those?
Right. And in terms of reliability, again, in terms of being gagged, we're looking at accounts that may not be able to post what they normally would post, and then are now focused on other campaigns, things that would otherwise be less contentious. So let's say if we look at a health campaign, for example, the CDC might now focus on air quality safety, or it may focus now on having a fire detector in your home. So things that are on a much lower scale of, scientific research.
More innocuous.
Right, right.
SMAC has been tracking dozens of these accounts. What are you learning by looking at some of these different accounts?
Sure. So we've noticed changes in the messaging. And I think one of the things I mentioned early on was the shift from more, science-focused posting now to more, I would say, just general resistance-based posting. And that is a shift that we really saw in after about the first 3 or 4 days of their existence. They made that big shift. And when I say resistance, I say things like posts about being against the wall with Mexico, posts against the immigration ban, posts really showing outcry against many of the Trump nominees that are currently now going before the Senate for either confirmation or for votes.
Have you ever seen this kind of viral effect on Twitter before? Some of these accounts now have hundreds and thousands of followers gained in a very short amount of time.
In terms of our lab, I don't think we've seen anything like that. But we do see viral phenomena creep up in very unexpected ways.
But usually that's about a particular post or a particular tweet. You know, one tweet goes viral. These accounts seem to have gone viral.
Yeah, in terms of accounts, I have not personally seen anything quite as powerful or that kind of growth, immediately and basically overnight for many of these.
So what do we make of that?
What I think is really going on is that we have a sense of, I think as you've described earlier, there is frustration about gag orders like this. There is a sense that there is a disruption in the course of how our nation deals with especially science and how, again, truth and reality are something that is being fought over right now. And when we look at something like Twitter, which, again, viral phenomenon are something that happen regularly. I mean, that's what Twitter is built on. But for attention to be driven to so many different kinds of accounts, again, we're now looking at about 80, maybe even more accounts that are doing about the same kind of work. When there's so much attention driven to those all at once, I think it certainly expresses concerns and it expresses kind of a groundswell of feeling about this general sense of resistance.
Will Twitter users actually end up vetting some of these accounts based on, what the content that is tweeted?
They may. And we have to keep in mind that Twitter, just because you follow somebody doesn't mean you agree with them either. And so just as we're seeing this groundswell of following, we're also seeing a lot of resistance and trolling to these accounts as well.
Sure. Well, I agree and disagree with some of these accounts. But if my BS detector goes off, whether I agree with it or not, I'm out of there. That's the way I am, at least.
Sure.
So I just wonder if Twitter users will say, I don't know if this is real. It doesn't matter whether I agree or disagree with it. I don't think that what they're providing here is accurate information or matters.
Right. And there's actually a very good example of that right now going on with the rogue staffer account in the Oval Office. And there's a lot of discussion.
There's a couple of those.
Right. And there's a lot of, you can see on the debate, if you ever look at the replies and the threads that form, you can see a lot of people really questioning and debating the legitimacy of the accounts. And I guess to answer your question is, yes, Twitter users do that pretty regularly. There is not a sense that there is just blind retweeting, all the time. That followers are very active, and this is a space where there is a lot of negotiation and fighting over what is in fact true.
So, a couple of the most disturbing, and we touched on this to me, are Rogue POTUS at Rogue POTUS staff and at Angry WH staffer, White House staffer. What do you make of those accounts? Have you taken a look at those?
I've looked at the Rogue POTUS staffer, and again, what's hard to determine with that one is, again, who exactly is producing it. And again, there are so many theories that emerge, and this is what gets interesting. We start to fall into the land of conspiracy theory because there are people who go in and do things like analyze all of the text and to say, this account may be coming from Russia because of a certain way that they abbreviate certain words, like I think vacation was one of them. They spelled it vacay, and Americans would use a V-A-C-A.
Sure.
And somebody said, well, they used to V-A-K-A, and that's only something that happens with people from a particular language set, right?
It could also be a typo, too. I was just looking at a keyboard here to see if the C and the K were closely.
It could be a typo, right?
But they're not. But
there is that level. I mean, what that really speaks to me is that there's such a level of distrust where any information is coming from right now. And that could be a very legitimate leak of a source. And at the same time, it would be very easy to parody something like that.
There have been a lot of attempts, at least according to some of these sites, of people trying to figure out who they are. And what they do is they try to backdoor it by saying, I've forgotten my password, and then they can get part of the phone number if a phone number has been associated with the Twitter account.
Right, and part of a phone number and part of an email address as well.
And then you can kind of put two and two together. That might be enough for someone in the West Wing to say, hey, you're out of here.
Right, that would be. And as well as any accidental mistakes, such as tagging a location, which would immediately indicate a space, or different kinds of shifts in terms of the device that individual is using. Some of these rogue accounts that I've been following, I can go back through and see when they've been passed over to different hands. There'll be abrupt shifts in style as well as device that's being used.
Have you noticed that with rogue POTUS staff? Do you think it's not one person?
I need to look at them. Okay. I haven't done that kind of analysis.
What account have you seen?
I looked at Rogue NASA, which originally started all.
So it may be. Some of these are not purporting to be one person. They're saying we are. They're using the word we, or there's we're a group of scientists or a group of national park rangers.
Right, exactly.
So you might end up seeing that. That wouldn't necessarily mean that the account is any less real or not.
Right. And it's, again, what we see are just shifts in practices where many of them begin as individuals, starting out to basically say, hey, I'm going to go rogue and post this information. And as they become part of a collective, they pass around the accounts or turn them over. And, that really does lead to one of the major issues is that, the reason many of these are on Twitter and not on a Facebook group, although there are some of these that have turned into Facebook pages and organizations, but so many of them are on Twitter because of the anonymity that is afforded. There are lots of potential protections. It is much easier to be anonymous in a space like Twitter than it is on Facebook. And so for us to be able to backtrack and make sense of who all these people are takes considerable effort.
With rogue POTUS staff and angry WH staffer, there's these tweets about the infighting that's happening in the Oval Office. And those are disturbing. But I guess what I'm not seeing is anything that it all seems to be reaction. There's nothing here that is saying, hey, coming up tomorrow, President Trump's going to talk to the Australian Prime Minister. Mm-hmm. It's after the Australian Prime Minister, after the conversation with the Australian Prime Minister, you get reaction to that. But do you think it would be easier to believe that this person is actually in the West Wing if they were to tweet something that has not happened yet, but then does?
I think that would be a smoking gun, so to speak. And that would show more leak than, again, like you say, reaction. And again, if anybody has access to news and they can talk about something that has happened and place their own spin on that and make it seem like a narrative coming out of the White House, any one of us could do that. And so I think you're exactly right. That would be a good hint that somebody has privileged information that is being leaked.
I guess if this battle between Reince Priebus and Steve Bannon that has been tweeted about on some of these rogue accounts actually ends up blowing up, then that might be a smoking gun.
Exactly.
Twitter is ephemeral. You've alluded to this. The tweets in my feed move very quickly. I see them, then they're gone. You'd have to scroll way back to find a tweet. If you lose track of it, forget trying to find it. I've lost track of some that I've wanted to find. Mm-hmm. I can't find them. Some are now getting deleted as well. Talk to me about what it seems to be an uptick in people actually capturing these tweets as an image and then tweeting the image rather than actually retweeting the tweet.
Right. So in terms of that practice, there are, again, a couple of rationale for doing that. Number one, especially when something becomes contentious or if there is a misspelling or again, like we could say, a smoking gun here that we are certain will get removed, that is becoming common habit where we archive on our own. And again, the amazing part of digital devices is that we have that ability. There are other things that can happen, too. In our lab, a lot of the work that we do is using Twitter's public API to regularly capture tweets from certain kinds of accounts or searches. And so what we end up having is the full text, as well as the Twitter identification number, as well as other telling metadata and details. And that, to me, becomes a more significant record. That's something that can be verified with Twitter. Images can be doctored. And that's not to say that everything that is retweeted can be doctored or is untrue in that sense. But there are people who can do things like write programs to make it look like a tweet. Photoshop is very easy to make something look like a tweet. And in fact, we've seen moments where people have gotten into fights over a tweet that looks like something they've produced, when in fact it's Photoshop
job. Sure.
Right.
Is there anything with the SMAC technology that would give you any insight into who the actual people are?
We are limited.
I guess what I'm asking, can I use the SMAC lab for evil?
For evil. Most technologies could be used for evil. I mean, that argument can be made. But in terms of backtracking, the kind of API, and again, that's the ability for us to knock on Twitter's door and ask for data. What Twitter gives to us is limited, but it's much broader than what you see on Twitter. And so there'd be a couple of things that we'd be looking for. I think things like timestamps, locations, if they're available. And again, most people running these accounts are very aware that everything they're doing is being watched closely. And so they are not following into the trap of allowing location services and tagging a location or a space. And then also, again, we look for devices. And so any shifts in devices, and if that's connected with a geolocation, that can hint at what may be happening. And also content. This is something that everybody else can do as well. I mean, track changes in the kinds of messages that are being made and when they're being made, in response or before certain news events, I think, just as you've alluded to.
Nate Carpenter heads the SMAC Lab at Illinois State University. That stands for Social Media Analytics Command Center. Carpenter spoke with GLT's Mike McCurdy. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Ecology Action Center is leading the way to develop a new solid waste plan for McLean County. The landfill in Bloomington is set to close in about a year. The EAC would lose money when the landfill closes because a portion of the landfill fees go to support the planning effort. In this conversation with GLT's Mike McCurdy, Center Director Michael Brown says the closure clock has been ticking for some time.
Traditionally, the EAC's solid waste programs, which is technically called the McLean County Solid Waste Program, through an intergovernmental agreement with McLean County, City of Bloomington, and Town of Normal. Traditionally, this has been funded through McLean County by a revenue source that's known as host fees. Essentially, these are the taxes that go on every load of waste that goes into the McLean County landfill. So the host fee is applied to every load of waste that goes into the McLean County Solid Waste Fund, and that has traditionally paid for us to do solid waste planning, education, outreach, and such in the community in order to promote more recycling and waste reduction. However, yes, the closure of the landfill, the anticipated closure of the landfill in the near future, means that revenue source is going away. It has been declining for a number of years already, and so we've seen this coming. We have been prepared for it. And so, yes, per the new intergovernmental agreement between the Ecology Action Center, Town of Normal, City of Bloomington, and McLean County, upon closure of the landfill, the cost of these services will be divided proportionally between those government entities.
Should we be concerned that the landfill is closing? Will we see costs go up? Will commercial customers see their individual waste hauling costs go up as a result of having to haul this waste somewhere else? Where? Livingston County?
So there's a couple different issues here, and it's actually kind of a complex question. To begin with, should we be concerned? Honestly, there's no reason to panic. Actually, the transition as the landfill closes should actually probably be seamless for most people, whether it's residential or business waste generators. Most people probably won't even notice any transition from the current McLean County landfill to to another landfill. As far as where our waste will go, the next two closest landfills in central Illinois would either be the Clinton landfill or the Livingston County landfill. So both those are within reasonable different distance, but yet, yes, are further away. So it might be logical that there would be some increased cost for disposal due to increased transportation costs.
You and the EAC have been leading the effort to develop a new solid waste plan for McLean County. The old one dates back to 25 years. A lot has changed in that quarter century. What are some of the more significant changes the new plan has to take into account?
So yeah, really a lot has changed in 20 years as far as technologies, as far as, you know, our waste generation habits, the materials we generate, what can be recycled, what can't be. So recent information does, you know, show us the current composition of our waste being generated in McLean County. There's a good number or a good quantity of those materials that through newer technologies or strategies could be reclaimed in one way or another, more so than traditionally. And so looking at materials such as construction and demolition waste or organic type materials, so food waste, things like this could, through some new strategies, be addressed better. And so we're looking at things like that. We're also looking at some of the gaps in services in our community, in particular, multifamily housing, so apartment buildings. We know in most of Bloom to Normal are not serviced by the residential programs. And so how can we better address that? Commercial waste, how can we help incentivize additional recycling or waste reduction by businesses. So it's things like this. So we're looking at, you know, the obvious, you know, gaps in services and the large volumes of materials that could be recycled that are currently going into landfill.
And we'll talk a little more about food waste and construction and demolition and multifamily housing in just a little bit. What has taken place over the last year as this plan has developed?
So over the past year or so, we've had a number of stakeholder groups working with us to identify some of the issues, some of these gaps, identify some of the newer technologies and strategies that we could try and include in the new plan. So yeah, we've really taken a lot of time to do a lot of research and a lot of discussions. We're actually at a point where we're just have a couple more stakeholder groups we're trying to convene in order to fill a few of these smaller remaining gaps in our plan before we put together the actual draft plan.
Who are some of the stakeholder groups?
So right now we're particularly looking at some of the organic materials and so food waste. So trying to look at some of the bigger institutions, some of the bigger grocery store chains, things like that here in the community. Look at what they're already doing. Look at what more can be done. Look at what, you know, there's support for. Because in the end, if there isn't support for the strategies that we're proposing, then there won't be much success.
I assume more people are recycling today than in 1991, which is the date of the last solid waste plan. But if you look back over the last 10 years or so, the rate has been fairly steady between 30 and 40%. What's going on there?
So there's a couple different variables there. So there's participation rates in recycling programs, which we definitely know have been increasing and Bloom to Normal as they've made recycling more convenient. But then there is the rates that you're referring to, the stagnation of the total community-wide recycling rate as far as, you know, how much waste we generated in McLean County over the past year and how much of that was, as a total, was recycled. And so there's two different rates, which sometimes do get a little confusing.
And I was asking about the amount going into the landfill versus the material that's being recycled.
Sure. But just to clarify, These are two related but different variables. We definitely know participation is going up, and that should contribute to a increase overall in the overall recycling rate. However, at the same time, we're living very much convenience lifestyles, you know, a lot of fast food, a lot of disposables, increased packaging on all of our consumer goods. The economy plays a role in this as well. We definitely have seen dips in total waste generated as the nation went into recession, and then as it recovered, we saw total waste generated jump considerably. And so there's a lot of different complicated variables here.
So increased participation doesn't automatically mean increased rates of recycling or materials being diverted from the landfill.
Correct, because at the same time, we could just be generating more waste overall.
That's Michael Brown with the Ecology Action Center. We're talking about a new 20-year solid waste plan for McLean County. Does recycling prevent landfill costs? If not as much as going into the landfill, does that save us, municipalities, someone money?
Sure. So the more we recycle, the more it does save taxpayer dollars, in that while recycling sometimes makes money, sometimes it actually, you know, costs money, but overall it is cheaper than landfilling. I mean, you're going to have similar collection services in terms of, you know, fleet of trucks, you know, labor to drive those trucks, but yet in the end, the landfilled materials are going to cost the municipality and therefore the taxpayers, you know, a good amount of money. Recycling, you might get some revenue from the sale of those items. Sometimes it's break even, sometimes it costs a little. But in the end, it is overall going to be much more cost effective than landfilling.
Can the county reach a high enough level of recycling to absorb the increased cost of hauling our garbage out of county? I would assume it would cost more to truck the garbage out of county rather than dump it in the county. Can enough be recovered to cover that cost if recycling goes up?
And that's what we're looking at right now. That is part of this planning process. We are trying to look at the big picture. We're looking at the next 20 years. We're looking at the economics as much as we can, even though there's a lot of, you know, variables that'll be hard to really estimate here in the short term. But yes, ideally, a very effective solid waste plan is going to have us adopt strategies that, while they may involve new and expensive technologies, but the cost savings from reduced landfill costs will eventually pay for these services. And we also need to consider the potential for increased costs, or as far as the potential for increased costs for increased transportation to a more distant landfill. Recent information from Allied Waste suggests that the economies of scale at Livingston County Landfill actually might mitigate any anticipated increased transportation costs. So there's that just another variable we need to take into consideration.
About 14% of landfill waste is food scraps. Ecology Action Center Director Michael Brown says some of that can be composted and used or resold. He says there are also other possible revenue streams from food waste. Landfill costs would need to be a lot higher than they are now in central Illinois, Brown says, to make some of the current alternative strategies cost effective. But in 20 years, things can change a lot. Brown spoke with GLT's Mike McCurdy. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas and the interviews you hear. Share your thoughts about the show at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Email us at news@WGLT.org. This is WGLT Normal, a service of Illinois State University.